we're running blind into a lot of these recommendations because we don't know the quantities of several nutrients in this food.
Increasing potassium towards the higher end of normal is in fact beneficial. We cannot just simply tell them, cut out your potassium.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks from Duke University, and we're here to cover another ASN Kidney Health Guidance, this time on potassium and phosphorus additives. We're joined today by the co-chairs, and I'll have both of them introduce themselves to us.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Viruete. I am an assistant professor and a registered dietitian in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. And I'm also an affiliate of the Division of Nephrology at Indiana University School of Medicine. And my research focuses on the role of diet in chronic kidney disease, particularly focused on chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorder, and the gut microbiome.
Hi, Matt. I'm Chabaka Vezdi. I am a professor of medicine and nephrology at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. I am an academic nephrologist, and as such, as I do clinical work, teaching and research, with my research being mostly in the areas of clinical epidemiology, outcomes and clinical trials, with a focus on metabolic disorders in patients with chronic kidney disease.
This is the third ASN Kidney Health Guidance. And so maybe you can first start with what exactly is a guidance as compared to a guideline?
You're right to point out the difference because it's subtle, but it's important. So guidance is less formal. The goal with these guidance documents is to provide easily digestible, practically applicable guidance from experts in the field on topics that are often controversial or where there is no substantial amount of clinical trial evidence, which may then make it difficult for healthcare providers or even patients to know what to do. So the ASN, as you mentioned, has done a couple of other guidances before, and this one deals with diet, which in our experience generates a lot of interest from everyone.
Most definitely. I think that potassium, phosphorus, these are two things that come up in just about every conversation that we have with a patient. And oftentimes, I think it is challenging to know what to say. So maybe we can first start there. Why potassium and phosphorus? What was the decision about why included those two?
That is a very interesting question, how this came about. In fact, it all started with a regulatory attempt or plan to replace some of the sodium additives in food with potassium additives. And this was rooted in data from the general population showing that potassium supplementation in the general population at least could be beneficial. And that plan met some resistance and concern from kidney advocacy groups who were concerned about what happens when patients with more advanced kidney disease would be exposed to higher amounts of dietary potassium unbeknownst to them. And hence, they reached out to the ASN, asked them for guidance about this issue. ASN found that or thought that the guidance document would be perfect for such a topic. And it convened a number of experts, initially thinking about potassium, but then that quickly expand it to more. And maybe Annabelle, you want to pitch in because I think the phosphorus came from you.
Yeah. So when I was first contacted, they mentioned this potassium additives and how it was important, particularly for patients. And then I mentioned that, in fact, usually when you read papers, when you talk with patients, you oftentimes kind of like merge the three together, which are sodium, potassium, and phosphorus. So we originally thought we were going to be working on sodium additives, potassium additives, and phosphorus additives. But we quickly realized that it was just a very, very big problem to tackle. So we therefore went with potassium and phosphorus additives, which are really a lot of the conversation, particularly the renal dietitians have with patients. And since, I mean, we haven't mentioned it, but in medical nutrition therapy or diet therapy, it has evolved quite a bit, in which originally we just focused on those nutrients in general, but more recently we have focused on the nuances of these nutrients, particularly how much or how well these additives are utilized in the body, meaning that they're absorbed and that could potentially affect outcomes of patients, meaning serum potassium, serum phosphorus, or any other outcomes.
Let's first talk about who was involved in making this guidance.
It was a great group of people. I was really fortunate to be co-chair with Shaba, but it was a big group. I think I counted 22 authors in the paper, but it was adult nephrologists, pediatric nephrologists, practicing renal dietitians, nutrition scientists, and also we had a food scientist. And we also had participation from patients. They had the chance to voice their concerns regarding potassium and phosphorus additives. So it was really a team effort coming with this guidance. And also it was very interesting to see very different points of view on how people saw these additives in their clinical practice, but also, for example, the food scientists mentioning how these are really purposeful for them in order to increase shelf life of products and create safe products for people consumption.
I might also add that the group was about equally split between experts in phosphorus and experts in potassium. So we wanted both fields to be represented all the way from basic science to clinical scientists and even implementation science, which we thought was very important given the complexity of this matter.
Congratulations to both of you for achieving this goal. Never easy to get that many people together on a topic. Before we jump into each of these, I want to just hear about what approaches y'all took to how this would be delivered to patients.
Yeah, so through different types of conversations, actually, we had several meetings for each work group. So the potassium, the phosphorus group, and also the implementation group. We created kind of three levels of strategies. One was the basic strategies, which are, these are intended to be general. They're intended to be applicable for general healthcare providers. So this could be the physician, nephrologist, this could be general dietitian, renal dietitian, or other allied healthcare. These are very simple. They're just promoting healthy diet intake, balanced meals, and also portion control. So really, these could be provided in your clinic. Then we moved into the advanced and the intensive strategies, and these are intended to specifically recommend or educate or counsel individuals to limit specific types of additives regarding potassium or regarding phosphorus, and also additional more intensive techniques, for example, demineralization techniques, which means that you recommend an individual to cook, for example, beans, soak them in water so that leaches a little bit of potassium and the phosphorus, and then cook those foods as regular. So these levels of interventions are based on the amount of information, but also the type of motivation that the patient may have, the resources that they may have, and also the time that clinicians may have, and the level of complexity of these.
And also the level of risk. So the determination from the healthcare provider would be, is this patient in need of detailed education about diet? For example, is the patient at high risk to develop hyperkalemia or at high risk to develop complications of CKD mineral and bone disorder? And then the second aspect, as Annabelle mentioned, is the patient willing to undergo more education to implement these oftentimes complex interventions that require label reading and knowing a lot more about the food stuff that they put on the table?
Got it. So it sounds like the group came up with two levels. One is sort of basic that probably happens or could happen in any patient encounter. The second one might require a little bit more in-depth discussion and detailed understanding of what exactly needs to be done and how that needs to be done that would actually take a little more work for the patient. That's sort of how you divided this up. Let's move on and talk about these two individually. And with that sort of context, what about potassium?
So potassium was our starting point. And again, it's important to separate the two because there are some major fundamental differences in how we relate to potassium and phosphorus. To start immediately with the health impact of added potassium, it became quite clear early that in the vast majority of individuals, people with normal kidney function and even individuals with CKD who have early stage chronic kidney disease, let's say stage 1 through 3A, added potassium is probably beneficial. High potassium diets are actually the ones that are healthier considering natural food. And even when considering potassium additives, there is now mounting evidence from various clinical trials that increasing potassium towards the higher end of normal is in fact beneficial in avoiding malignant arrhythmias, for example, or even leading to better blood pressure control and decreased stroke risk or cardiovascular event risks. So that requires a very nuanced approach to what we recommend to our patients because we cannot just simply tell them that, you know, cut out your potassium, right? For most of them, this is beneficial. So we started by a description of potassium physiology, pathophysiology, how additives come into play, because again, let's emphasize, we are not discussing diet in general. We are very specifically focusing on additives in food. And that makes it even more complex because when it comes to potassium, you know, data is not great. We know that foods do contain excess potassium. Some studies suggest that anywhere between 15 to maybe 40% of foods out there contain some form of additive, but the type of additive and the amount of potassium contained in these foods can vary tremendously. And sometimes it is very, very difficult to determine what exactly is in the food and how much of it is present. So with that in mind, we provide tables to describe the types of additives that could be found. And then importantly, we provide sort of a guidance about how to approach this question. Number one, who are the patients at risk for hyperkalemia, starting with stage of chronic kidney disease, concomitant medications, comorbidities, and so on and so forth. And then the interventions that are to be tailored based on the risk level with the low-risk patients, for example, those with normal kidney function at low risk for hyperkalemia events, we say that potassium additives may in fact be beneficial and could be considered as a therapeutic intervention, i.e. increasing additives or potassium supplementation. And then you go on to the other side to a patient that's at high risk for hyperkalemia, in whom a restriction of potassium intake should be considered. And that's where we end up with these more complex, more advanced interventions that would require label reading and knowing a lot more about the type of food that you're eating.
I think these are really important points. And one of the challenges is giving a patient two messages. One, potassium is good. Two, excessive potassium is bad. And especially when you're talking about CKD, which is a process that is kind of progresses over time, and we make an artificial line to say, well, 45, 30, whatever your mark is, at what point do they start to become higher risk and you have to limit the potassium? Do we really know that answer?
Spot on, Matt. I have to say that we grappled a lot about where to draw that line. And we had, in fact, repeated requests during the review process from external reviewers, from editors who tried to compel us to provide that line. And we had to push back because there is no line. As you just said, chronic kidney disease is a progressive condition where, you know, these thresholds are rather arbitrary. And an individual's risk for hyperkalemia depends on more than just their kidney function level. It depends on, again, concomitant medications, other comorbidities. So it's very important to individualize this risk assessment and apply it to the entirety of the risk factors that an individual patient presents with.
Now, I want to stay with food and potassium. And one thing I want to clarify is that, is it the potassium in the food or is it the food that the potassium is in that is the beneficial part of it? And so my question basically is, a banana, an orange, various other fruits and vegetables that contain potassium have a lot of other things in it that are good. And so avoiding potassium sometimes leads to another problem, which is the other stuff in the food that you cannot eat. Can you describe sort of how we deal with that?
I can definitely comment to that. And I think it's a combination of things. As a dietitian, I will tell you, obviously, nutrients are not consumed in isolation. And for the homeostasis of potassium, we know that there are several factors that could control that. Just thinking about the diet component of it, dietary fiber could be an important component because we know once kidney function starts declining, an excretion through the colon is an important mechanism to try to maintain homeostasis. And therefore, dietary fiber in that way, it's beneficial because it increases bowel movements and it can increase the excretion of potassium to maintain normal levels. Also, other components you mentioned, for example, bananas, carbohydrate, the release of insulin. We also know that that is a specific mechanism for the handling, cellular handling of potassium. So it does depend. I do think that it does depend the types of food that people consume, just because people consume foods and not nutrients. I'm just saying this as a dietitian. But another factor that you may kind of like are targeting there is how recently, we are moving into the nuances of the absorption of where the nutrient is coming from. Meaning, for example, if the potassium is coming from a food additive, the accessibility or the absorption of that potassium may be easier than if, for example, the potassium is consumed in plant-based foods, which there is a food matrix in, which means that probably the absorption may be less. So I don't know if Csaba, you want to comment a little bit more on that too.
It is important to differentiate. And I might just add that one additional reason to target, separate the nutritional aspect of the dietary intervention when we're targeting additives, because you can just take them out without affecting the protein content, the carbohydrate and fat content of the food that's involved, as opposed to, as you indicated, Matt, you tell the patient to eat fewer bananas. Well, that will have all this downstream effect of affecting protein, carbohydrate intake, and so on and so forth. So additives are really a prime target for these interventions that would attempt to cut out specifically one or two components such as potassium or phosphorus from the diet.
Maybe we can move on to additives and describe the different additives. And then lastly, you mentioned the FDA sort of came to ASN about this topic. I was curious if there's a strategy to list the potassium content. How much is from additive? How much is from the basic food?
The nutrition facts label, potassium is a mandated nutrient, so it means that it's included in the label and we do have a quantitative amount. However, there's no distinction between how much is naturally occurring in a food product or if it's added in the form of a potassium additive, for example. Another key limitation is the way in which companies that are manufacturing these foods report potassium. So according to the Code of Federal Regulation, actually the way that potassium is mandated, it can be underreported. So it just like goes on the lower end of the amounts. So with this underreporting, it could be potentially detrimental, particularly for people with kidney disease. And also for us dietitians, where we're trying to come up with diet plans, we cannot accurately calculate the amount of potassium that a food contains. So there's been several studies in which they have measured specifically the amount of potassium, and it could vary from the amount of potassium that is reported in the food label.
So just to be clear, currently on the label, it's just potassium as a whole. Mm-hmm. We don't have a breakdown of how much of it's from the food versus how much is from an additive. What are the typical additives that are used for potassium, and what is it typically put into?
So there are different types of potassium additives. From reviewing some of the evidence, and particularly the work of Kelly Picard, who has published quite a bit on this topic of both potassium and phosphorus additives, we came with the top four that we believe are the ones that are contributing the most to the potassium additives in foods. And these are potassium chloride, which is the one that is traditionally substituting sodium chloride, potassium phosphate, potassium citrate, and potassium lactate. So particularly potassium chloride and potassium phosphates are the ones that are going to be including in a lot of products. So most of the products that say low sodium are going to be containing potassium chloride. There are a lot of particularly snack products, bread products that use both the potassium chloride and particularly potassium phosphate. But really, it's a variety of food products that contain these additives in them.
And one difficulty would be to determine how much potassium specifically comes from additives. And as you indicated, Annabelle, there is very limited data. But there, if I remember, we are quoting a study where they compared foods with and without additives with similar amounts of nutrient content. And that suggested that simply by having the additives could add as much as 50 millimoles per day of potassium, which, considering that the healthy recommended amount would be 100 to 120 millimoles per day, that is really a substantial amount of potassium that could come from additives.
Now, early we talked about the FDA and food companies were considering switching out sodium salts for potassium salts. Is this happening, or is this still a consideration?
That is definitely happening. Sometimes when you just go to the store, I tend to just look into the labels and you see that the ingredients definitely contain potassium chloride particularly. And one other thing, so the addition of potassium into nutrition facts label happened relatively recently. I think it was like 10 years ago. And one of the things that this did is because potassium is a nutrient of concern for the general population, meaning that we want people to consume more because of all of the benefits that we already talked about for the general population, particularly reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. And therefore, this may incentivize the food companies to increase the content of potassium in the form of these potassium additives. So they can look for ways in order to incorporate these additives in order to bump that potassium content.
The major change that was being considered is to allow the food industry to do this without any particular additional approval process. So there are certain food standards that are being used for foods that are commonly marketed and sold, and they have a certain standard composition. And this is more of a topic for a dietitian or a food scientist, so I'm a little bit on thin ice here. But my understanding is that sodium-based salt are a core component of those foods. And this change in regulation would allow the switching out of sodium salts for potassium salts without any major approval process or information campaign. So it would be sort of subtle and potentially unknown to patients.
It sounds like the guidance is that potassium is in general good up to a certain point where it might need to be restricted. And maybe we'll start first on the good part. And we didn't really define exactly what that GFR is. You alluded to potentially 3A. How much should we be targeting for patients?
I think most would say 100 to 120 millimoles per day, which is essentially the DASH diet, probably the best known heart-healthy diet that's rich in foods, vegetables, nuts. It doesn't contain as much red meats and so on and so forth. So that would be an amount that is in general recommended for cardiovascular health.
And Annabelle, can you describe a little bit about how you would tell a patient to achieve that much?
Yeah, so there are definitely different resources that are available in order to get from a food perspective, kind of like food group perspective, because these types of diets, and Chaba mentioned, this will be more like the DASH diet, in which we are really recommending a high intake of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and low-fat dairy in order to increase that level or have that achieve that level of potassium, which I know Chava mentioned millimoles. I think about milligrams, so it's about 4,700 milligrams of potassium a day. So that would be a recommendation, particularly for those that are not at risk of hyperkalemia. However, once we start getting into the nuance of what is the good or the bad, I do think that for sure, in this guidance, we don't come for a consensus just because we're targeting the additives portion of it. And we know that, I mean, although they can contribute to a specific amount of the potassium in the diet, the most of the potassium is also could come from just like the natural sources of food, which would be your fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and dairy.
And now maybe we can talk about this group of patients that might need to limit potassium and how do you go about that?
As opposed to phosphorus, and we'll talk about that in a minute, potassium has a very good biomarker, which is essentially serum or plasma potassium. Just measure the potassium level, because physiologically, the harm associated to elevated potassium to hyperkalemia, most would agree that it is electrophysiologic in nature and immediate, acute or subacute effects. So you worry about the instantaneous increase in potassium level causing an arrhythmia and a major cardiovascular event such as VTAC or cardiac arrest, sudden cardiac death. As such, we can monitor our patients, and the studies that looked at risk of future hyperkalemia showed that, you know, history of past hyperkalemia is one of the strongest risk factors of that. So we would assess our patients, again, as individuals, looking at their risk, look at their history of hyperkalemia. If I have a patient whose potassium levels have always been in the low normal range, I'm more concerned about maybe we need to raise that potassium in light of recent data. Then we look at the kidney function, obviously. So if somebody is approaching CKD stage 5, we know that in general, that makes homeostasis more difficult. So a large load of potassium may be more difficult to dispose of. So they are at risk for hyperkalemic events. If they are on medications such as ACE inhibitors or ARBs, on which, by the way, most of our patients should be on, we know that they raise the risk of hyperkalemia. If they're diabetic, that could be a risk factor. Diabetics are more prone to develop hyperkalemia. So it's really a combination of all of these factors that will lead a practitioner, a nephrologist, a physician to determine that maybe this patient is at risk for hyperkalemia and we need to examine restriction in some form.
From a diet perspective, if I just may add, an assessment will be also very needed, and particularly a comprehensive assessment to see if diet has, we need to do any specific type of restriction. A lot of times we tend to think that, oh, it's a patient with stage five, they should automatically go into a restricted diet. And that is sometimes is not the case. And therefore, just doing a good diet assessment is very important to see where the potassium is coming from and the added risk that particular patient may have, as Csaba just mentioned.
Let me just buttress this point, because I think it's very important, since there are actually voices out there in the community that suggest that hyperkalemia risk is not affected by diet. And I think we have to debunk this as a black or white statement. And there is considerable nuance to this, because most people would argue that postprandial hyperkalemia is a real thing. So there is absolutely a possibility that an individual could develop a transient hyperkalemia as a result of an increased bolus coming in a meal. And as such, typically, when I first send patients to our dietitian for hyperkalemia reason, I'm really looking for that smoking gun, because they could identify an excessive amount of something that's not important. I had a patient who tended to eat a whole watermelon in one setting. Normal kidney function. Surprise, surprise, he came in the next morning with hyperkalemia. So things like this happen. And in that case, you know, you just recommend moderation or cut out that one thing without affecting nutritional status, still being able to maintain a healthy diet.
Yeah, I see an increasing trend towards beet juice shots, which contain quite a lot of potassium. And there's TikTok videos surrounding that. They say promote kidney health, but if you take a lot of them, it can cause pretty significant hyperkalemia. And we've seen that. Now, we mentioned the two strategies, the basic and advanced. What are some of the advanced strategies?
So we would probably recommend some more education, particularly with label reading, so we can educate them on what to look for. So specifically, if there is a potassium additive, and when we focus on specific additives, we mentioned the top four that are likely to contribute more to potassium intake, which are, I'm going to just say them again, potassium chloride, potassium phosphate, potassium citrate, and potassium lactate. Also looking into the quantities, that could also, even though it could be underreported, that could also be an additional source of information for them. We mentioned demineralization techniques, which are particularly important for potassium intake and modulating that potassium intake. And then the more intensive strategies go into going into the detailed diet history of that particular patient and looking for those foods that may be contributing to the potassium intake in general that also contain those potassium additives, and try to limit the consumption of a specific foods rather than all of the foods with potassium additives.
All right, well, let's move on to phosphorus. This is another big challenge in the nephrology clinic. And I guess the biggest problem is it's everywhere and really hard to tackle. So maybe we'll start with the strategies, and then we can go through dietary. And then also, it has its own whole area of additives.
Before we jump into additives, I think it's important to mention, as we alluded to this with the potassium section, that There are a couple of things about the phosphorus additives that make it very different from the potassium additives. First and foremost, as we mentioned with potassium, that in most individuals, potassium additives could be beneficial. There is no such thing with phosphorus additives. At least in a modern society where malnutrition is not an issue, potassium additives serve no health benefits. Okay, so as such, approaching this from purely health standpoint is much easier, because in the vast majority of the individuals, you could say that you're probably better off with less amounts of phosphorus additives. And then the other fundamental difference in this question is that for phosphorus, we really don't have a good biomarker. So for potassium, we have hyperkalemia, and it's relatively easy to determine which patient is at risk for hyperkalemia. With phosphorus, it's really insidious, because it starts very early. Even in individuals with normal kidney function, you may have a pathophysiology where the cardiovascular and bone effects of that excess phosphorus is already starting. And then it would gradually increase with advancing stages of chronic kidney disease. So it's more of a linear, insidious, unrecognized detriment that we didn't have with potassium. And that made our approach very different in the sense that we don't have a safe zone or a safe category where we could tell patients to just, you know, eat away, but rather we grade the recommendation in that we cannot see any overt risk in you, but still it may be better to limit that as a way of a healthy general diet advice, as opposed to individuals who may have overt cardiovascular disease or calcification, where you would embark on those more advanced techniques.
That's a great way to put it. So it looks like that's the challenge for the clinician also, because they're giving several very mixed signals with especially potassium. Oftentimes they hear, oh, potassium's bad. Then you say, no, it's actually good, but you can't have a lot of it, depending on your kidney function and risk factors and patient-centric issues. Now, for phosphorus, it's a little bit different. You say, just, you can't have it. Now, what really concerns me mostly is you said that companies or food companies are interested in making healthier food by adding this potassium, but it doesn't seem they have the same feelings about phosphorus. Why is that? Why are they using so many additives when there's nothing good about it?
So we have to remember why they use these additives. And really is to, we talked about shelf life, but we also can mention mouthfeel, the texture of the food, holding into more water, looking plump, kind of like, for example, for meat products, if we think about chicken, if we think about shrimp, to maintain a specific color. So that is a reason why they're using these additives. It's not just to increase the level of phosphorus, but it's really to provide those benefits to the food products that they're producing. And as we mentioned, I mean, I mentioned potassium being a nutrient of concern for the general population because the population as a whole were under consuming potassium. It's not that case also for phosphorus. We're really, data from NHANES shows that we are consuming almost half or more than half of what the RDA for phosphorus is, which is 700 milligrams. NHANES data suggests that we're consuming 1,500 milligrams of phosphorus. Yes, and that is in the general population, some people with kidney disease. But it has been shown also in people with kidney disease. So it's not that we're under-consuming phosphorus.
So it's adding to, looks better. The soda has a nice dark look to it. The meat looks more plump and juicy. And so it sells food.
Exactly. In terms of like the diet components of it, actually, we as renal dietitians have moved really more towards this nuanced approach in which they are recommending patients to avoid additives. And we have been doing this for a while. There was a 2013 paper, I believe, in JAMA by Sullivan and collaborators that did a study in hemodialysis patients, very relatively simple intervention, just telling patient to avoid additives or just reading the label and avoid PHOS. And in that way, they showed a difference in serum phosphorus levels over a very short period of time. I believe it was 3 months of the intervention. So since that paper, there's been several others that followed up suggesting that focusing on additives could make a difference into not only phosphorus concentration, but also some other parameters of chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorder, talking PTH, FGF23, et cetera.
What is PHOS?
That is the first part of how phosphorus additives are mentioned. So for example, if it's potassium phosphate, so that phosphate will contain the PHOS. Now, this rule is simple to tell people to read the ingredients, but there are also some some other additives that actually do not contain the PHOS that also are phosphate additives. An example, which is actually very prevalent in the food supply, is lecithin, which is one organic food additive that contains phosphorus. Modified cornstarch is another one that doesn't have the PHOS, but it's also a phosphate additive. So that PHOS rule is helpful, but it does not avoid all of the phosphate additives.
So if you pull up the ingredients, it's going to say phosphate PHOS. That's one way you get your patients to read those labels to see if that's in there. And then if it's in there, just don't eat it.
Sometimes it's very hard to avoid all of the phosphate additives, but if we focus in those overall categories that may are not providing that much nutrition, let's say, for example, snacks that provide, perhaps they're just providing added sugars, fats, and phosphate additives or sodium too, they're probably not providing the most nutrition versus some others that may contain also other nutrients and are more nutrient dense rather than energy dense snacks.
So when you mentioned the double of phosphate that Americans are eating, is the majority of that doubling from the additives?
So that is a hard question to answer, because as in contrast to potassium, phosphorus is not in the nutrition facts label, meaning that the manufacturers do not need to provide the content of phosphorus. So a lot of these calculations have been from, for example, the US database that does not contain the phosphorus in all of, for example, the branded products. However, there's been some studies that suggest that the contribution of additives could be important, from like 800 to up to 1,000 milligrams of phosphorus.
I might just add to that, that indeed, it could be a high amount in general. And also importantly, it's very absorbable. And that's another reason why targeting phosphorus additives is important, because the naturally occurring phosphorus, especially the one coming from vegetables and non-meat products, is much less absorbable. So even though the amount in the food may be a certain amount, if only half of it gets absorbed, then obviously the biological impact would be much less.
So right now, currently on the nutrition label, they're not required to put how much phosphorus is in the food. But if you look at the ingredients, PHOS, phosphate, is there. And so you just basically infer that it's probably a lot and try to avoid it.
I tend to think of it more instead of a quantitative amount, more of a qualitative recommendation, because we really don't know. So one example could be cola products. It has phosphoric acid, and that phosphoric acid, remembering this number wrong, but it was more like in the 40 milligrams. So perhaps the amount of phosphorus that it could contribute maybe on the lower end versus some other products, for example, meats that may have more on their the portion size. We really don't know specifically the quantity for all of these products that contain the PHOS or the phosphorus additives.
So it sounds like in this guidance, phosphate in general is we're consuming too much, and it has downstream consequences that are bad for your health. Maybe we can specifically talk about CKD and strategies that to work with the patient. You mentioned looking at the label and finding PHOS. What are some other strategies that a patient can use to remove the phosphate and reduce the amount that they're taking?
So one would be going even to the basic recommendations or strategies, because just as a reminder, we're calling them basic, but they're still very important. These recommendations are suggesting individuals to consume a healthy dietary pattern, balanced meals, try to consume minimally processed foods, meaning that these foods will not contain additives. They will be on their more natural way of consuming, like a whole fruit, a whole vegetable, whole grains, etc. So in that way, we would be limiting the amount of phosphorus additives because we're consuming less foods that contain those phosphorus additives. Then more on the advanced and intensive strategies would be educating individuals on how to read the food labels and look for a specific additive. So we mentioned the PHOS, but also if, for example, a person is consuming a lot of instant products, let's say cocoa powder or something like that, that could contain a lot of lecithin that could be contributing to more phosphorus. So that would be more on an individual basis based on their diet history and working with that individual.
Is there any movement from the FDA to include the amount of phosphorus in food, or is that just not going to happen?
Fighting with windmills, I guess. So as the listeners might know, the ASN has been in this fight for a long time, trying to achieve inclusion of phosphorus in the food label, but so far with not much success.
Yeah, I just want to highlight, I am biased because Dr. Sharon Moe is my mentor. She was my postdoc mentor. But when she was president of ASN, that was her main goal, to advocate for including phosphorus in the food label. So they wrote letters to the FDA. They worked in collaboration with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They submitted comment when the nutrition facts label was reorganized, and they were able to include potassium, but we were not successful in including phosphorus. There's definitely push from the kidney health community, the nutrition community, because also it will make our job as dietitians easier. We're running blind into a lot of these recommendations because we don't know the quantities of several nutrients in this food.
And again, we're facing a problem that the population with CKD, at least I suppose, in the eye of the regulator, is a relatively smaller segment of the population, especially those at high risk. And then the other issue is that, again, as we mentioned before, the impact of phosphorus additives and phosphorus in the food is really difficult to quantify. It's not so easy to point to how many patients may be affected when you sort of guess that it could start early and could be insidious, but it's much less of a compelling story than telling somebody how increasing potassium could cause hyperkalemia.
Any last comments that either one of you have about phosphorus?
I think in this way, our job was just highlighting the work of other people that have published trials showing that limiting phosphate additives is a good thing. We're over-consuming phosphorus. So to us, educating individuals on how to limit phosphorus additives with maintaining diet quality is probably the key message for us.
I think it's also a good message to show that avoiding foods that have a lot of phosphorus additives is probably you're picking healthier choices at that point, and so that's good. And then also consuming a diet higher in potassium if it's safe and you've had that discussion with your physician. Both of those kind of go together for a healthier diet, which hopefully will improve outcomes for our patients. Thank you so much, both of you. Any comments you have about working on these guidances and what's your overall sort of feel about now that you've gone through one from the moment you got the email and invitation till now? What would your advice to someone who gets asked to be on a health guidance and engage in a project like this?
It was a very gratifying process for me. Even though all of us spend a lot of time doing research and clinical practice that touches upon these issues, by working closely with such a great group of experts who have complementary expertise in various aspects of these topics. Personally, I learned a lot. It was really an eye-opener regarding various aspects of what we discuss in this guidance. And I would just emphasize that for anybody who participates in these processes, we are doing some good. And in the process, we are also getting better.
I would echo what Achava said. For me as an early career researcher, it was also very rewarding just to interact with all of the people that I read papers about. And one of the things that I really enjoyed was the discussion. It was not that we were all on the same page all the time, but it was that discussion back and forth that really made the paper really, really rewarding. I also want to highlight the support that we had from Sarah Samsel, because she was amazing in keeping us in line to meet the deadlines, which was a tight deadline, which at some point we thought we were not going to make it. But yeah, it was a great experience.
As a reader and a consumer of these guidances, it's been great because I've seen some trainees grasp onto some of these ideas, and it's like basically taking the science and trying to really implement them in an individual patient. That's the hardest thing to do. And that's really what the attempt to do is. And maybe we don't have all the answers right now, but at least we have enough to give that guidance so that we can sit with our patient and really give them the best approach that we have currently. And so I really like that. And I think I'm really proud to be part of ASN, and this is a great initiative. So thanks to both of you for joining me on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast, and we look forward to the next ASN Kidney Guidance in the near future. So thank you.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.